Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, here's where we're starting the week. At 9:30, we'll head to Champlain College. At 10, we'll learn about the Montpelier Development Corporation. And we'll finish off in Tunbridge, meeting the owner and the goats of Villa Velicula Farm. But we're going to start the week by taking one of our listeners' suggestions. A few weeks ago, when we talked about great places today to take visitors in Vermont, we mentioned Hope Cemetery in Barrie. One of our callers said that that could be perfectly paired with the Vermont Granite Museum on the Barrie Montpelier Road. Brilliant idea. So we start today speaking with Scott McLaughlin, the executive director of the Granite Museum. And Scott, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Scott, or if you want to share a visit you've made to the museum, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Scott, it seems like there always should have been a museum in Barrie commemorating the granite industry and the great stone cutters, but when and how did the museum finally come to be?
So there was a community meeting in 1994 at the Barrie Opera House, and those that were in attendance, many of them were seniors, were looking at trying to solve a number of different problems. One was economic. There was vacant buildings in the downtown. They saw some economic depression that was occurring in the 1980s and 90s. And then they were also looking at the fact that a lot of the young people in the community just didn't have an understanding of the importance of the granite industry to not only Central Vermont, but also the state as well. And then thirdly, they were looking for a community space where they could celebrate the ethnic heritage of Barrie in the Central Vermont region. And so that ultimately created a committee which decided that the best thing to do was to create a museum. And so that's how it was born. By 96, they started looking at trying to select a particular location. And by 98, they had the Jones Brothers Granite Plant chosen and purchased, thanks to fundraising efforts by just a really dedicated team of folks living in the Central Vermont region, including those working in the granite industry. And for the 1990s and early 2000s, they spent a lot of energy put into trying to restore the building. It's a 27,000-square-foot building, so it's a good-sized granite plant. And it was in disrepair. And I came on board in 2015 full-time to turn the museum into a reality. It was largely a vacant building. The Stone Art School end had been completed, but the museum had not. And so that's what we've been working on as a community since 2015, is trying to get a museum off the ground, and most recently the Stone Art School.
Well, what will people find at the museum? And, Scott, start first outside.
So outside, the first thing you'll see is a train, mm-hmm. one that was used in order to carry blocks of granite from 1949 to the 1970s. And it took them from the quarries up at Millstone Hill down into Barrie and other granite plants in the Barrie area as well that were connected to the rail lines. There's also sculptures that are out there, and we'll be adding to that. We have a three-quarter-mile walking trail, and starting in just a couple of weeks, we'll be turning that into a packed gravel path, one that someone could use a wheelchair on, and giving full ADA compliance accessibility to the sculpture park that will develop on our 11.5 acres of land. And so those are some of the features you'll see outside. And then when you go inside the building, we have about 45 different displays, including the works of the active artists in the granite industry, about a dozen of them. And then that dominates about a third of the building. And the other two-thirds consist of historical collections that go back a century and a half, illustrating how you go from raw block right to finished product, and ultimately ship it out and place it on display either in public park, cemetery, or someone's backyard.
When did the granite industry get going, get started in Barrie?
It actually starts right after the War of 1812. Community was looking at trying to face some of the brick buildings that are being constructed. It's called underpinnings. It's just at the bottom of the ground level. They're looking for pieces of stone over doorways and windows. They're also looking for millstones. And so that's how we get Millstone Hill in Barrie. And a lot of the high-quality granite that's required for millstones is not found everywhere we find granite. So Barrie ended up becoming the primary location for northern Vermont millstones, and they were dragged during the winter during the 1820s right on through until the railroads arrived in the late 1840s. They continued to be used right through the 1880s. So that was one of its primary products originally.
Mm. Now, you mentioned earlier the ethnic heritage of Barrie, and that really is tied to the granite industry. Where did waves of stonecutters come from at various times to work in the quarries and create the monuments there in Barrie?
Mm-hmm. So initially, they used the locals. They didn't necessarily have the depth of knowledge about how to work stone, but they experimented. Many of them were part-time farmers and part-time quarrymen, and made simple pieces, fence posts, underpinnings, millstones. Eventually, though, we'll see with the railroad's arrival in the region an increase in potential for businesses. And so that attracts young men who have more knowledge about working stone. So they're coming from other New England quarry sites, not necessarily always granite, but marble and other stones. And then that attracts those that are coming from Europe directly and coming from stone centers. Aberdeen, Scotland is a great example. Carrara, Italy, Fuente del Spain, rock centers that have a history in stone going back centuries. And so they saw the opportunity to make their own mark by coming to Barrie at the end of the 19th century. And it was one of those communities that was just beginning to grow. So there's lots of opportunities to make your mark, start your own business, and draw on this new labor force that's just flooding in at the time.
Was there a heyday or golden age of stone cutting in Barrie?
Well, I'd say it still continues. We're taking out as much stone, if not more, than ever before in the past. Turning into just as many products. We see there's, starting in 1902, Barrie becomes the primary community in North America to provide dimensional block granite as well as finished monuments. And it held that position in North America right through the 1950s. Now there's more granite centers. They've become opened up as they've been found during the 20th century. And there's different labor markets throughout North America. So Barrie doesn't dominate like it used to in terms of the quantity of stone that's coming out of a community, but it certainly dominates when it comes to the artistic talent and quality of work compared to others in North America.
Barrie seems to be the epicenter of Vermont granite, but I know there are granite sheds over in Montpelier. I recently heard about Bethel white granite, and so there was some stone cutting in Bethel. Where else was the granite industry in Vermont?
So all along the eastern side of the state, running from the U.S.-Canadian border almost to the southern part of the state, there are outcroppings of granite, and they vary in quality. And quality meaning the crystal sizes that the granite is made up of. Obviously, want something small and fine that gives you a good quality surface. You also want one that has crystal alignment. When it cools, it has to cool fairly rapidly. And this is hundreds of millions of years ago, and it took literally tens of thousands of years to cool, but it's relatively fast geologically. And so that granite being aligned makes it easier to predict how it's going to split and how you're going to be able to work it. You can go to small communities like Kirby. You can go to Derby. in the Northeast Kingdom area, and then you can go all the way down to Brattleboro. There's good quality granite in Reigate. There's some in Calais. So they're all over the eastern side, and you'll find the quarries. Some of them were experimental. There wasn't a lot of material taken out, but they're all on hilltops. It's where the glaciers have ripped off all the topsoil, ground off all the soft rock, exposing the granite below, and that's where you'll find it. Much of it's now on, in terms of the quarries, they're on private property or public lands, and most are not well known. And we're at the museum just trying to create a database of all the known quarries. There's hundreds of them along the eastern side of the state.
Wow, that's interesting. What other industries grew up around Barry's granite industry?
The most important would be the tool industry. There are dozens of tool manufacturers starting in the 1820s that took the opportunity to partner with the granite industry to try to solve their problems of how to cut, manipulate, shape that stone, and then also ship it to the product to market. And so the tool industry was critical to the survival of the granite industry and its growth. Without them, during the 19th and early 20th century, Barry would have been slow in its progress of making its mark. Eventually it would because of the quality of stone, but it would have had to take and utilize the tool manufacturing regions elsewhere within the United States. Instead, they were right here, right in the central Vermont region. You also had the Rutland region, which was supplying tools that were for the marble region. And so those same companies, they provided a lot of the resources that are still used in some of the granite plants today. And one of the most important that still remains today is a tool company, is Trowel and Holden. They make all the hand tools for the granite industry. And no one would think to use anything else but Trowel and Holden tools.
All right, Scott, we've got some calls. Let's go to Betty first from Barry. Hi, Betty.
Good morning, Rick.
Morning.
Good morning, Scott. I have a question, a couple questions, actually. I don't remember if they had a festival last year or when they had the last festival. I know they used to have it back in the early 2000s because they had some couple classes down there on sculpting, because I remember Giuliano Ciccinelli taught it. And I took a couple classes down there and did some sculpting, and they're probably still down there on display. But I haven't heard nothing, and I know he used to do tours at the cemetery, too, at Hope Cemetery. But I haven't heard nothing about the festivals, because they used to, artists used to do things, and then they'd raffle it off and have a dinner and a barbecue. But I haven't seen that lately. I don't know if I just lost track of it, or
all
what
right.
the story was.
Well, Betty, let's give Scott a chance. First of all, Scott, let's talk about festivals still happening.
Yes. So every year, the Granite Museum bookmarks its season one festival in May. It's an opening day extravaganza. And then the Granite Festival, which occurs in either September or October. And you know, we have done that every year, except for because of the pandemic. We didn't do it last year. We haven't done it this year, and we hope to bring it back next year in full force. So hopefully bigger and better next year, since we haven't been able to have it the last 2 years.
All right, Betty, so you'll have to hold out till next year, but that should be back, of course, you know, as long as we get out from under this pandemic. And she did mention Hope Cemetery. You know, it has those wonderful ornate headstones. Are tours given? I know people can just go and wander the grounds when they'd like, which I love doing, but are there tours at Hope Cemetery?
So we haven't been doing organized tours from the museum, but I have been doing it for bus companies. I've got a couple of tours coming up in the next couple of weeks. But again, next year we're hoping we can do more in terms of tours for the cemetery, just like with our events. We'd like to bring that all back. I know it's been a request by many. There used to be regular tours in the cemetery. It just hasn't happened in recent years, but keep an eye on the museum's website, and you'll see when they'll be available for next season.
All right. And that is vtgranitemuseum.org, Betty. Let's talk a little bit about Hope Cemetery. You know, why do we see those wonderfully ornate and interesting headstones there at Hope Cemetery? And are there other cemeteries in the area or the state that has anything like what we see at Hope?
Well, there are other cemeteries like Hope in terms of the quality of artwork. Green Mountain Cemetery in Montpelier is a great example. Mm-hmm. There's also Elmwood Cemetery in Barrie. Because of the fact that you've got the granite manufacturing plants, the quarries, the artists, they're all located in central Vermont that are working in granite, and so that's where they're going to be buried. And for Hope Cemetery, it's been a showcase for the granite industry since the 1890s. The city and also the granite manufacturers decided early on that it was going to be only buried grade. It was going to be allowed in the cemetery. Mm-hmm. And it's been pretty restrictive in terms of the quality of work that's in the cemetery. And everybody's sort of excelled at trying to make bigger and better the monuments that are installed each season. So. Constantly changing. New pieces are added, and some of them are even better than some of those of the past.
Mm. All right, let's take another call. Fred's joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Does Vermont produce more granite than the Granite State?
Ah, here we go, a border war. Fred, great question. Vermont versus New Hampshire, do we know which produces more granite?
So in terms of monumental artwork, and that would certainly be Vermont, in terms of curbing and architectural elements, it's a toss-up between Vermont with the Woodbury Quarry and the Concord Quarry. Both are stones that are being used by Swenson Granite Company, which is owned by Polycor out of Quebec City. And so I don't know who's got the final numbers, but I'm sure someone does at Swenson in terms of the quantity of stone that's being removed from the two quarries. But those two quarries service the architectural granite that's needed, not only here in the Northeast, but even beyond.
I'm going to say, Fred, that based on what Scott told us, it looks like Barrie is truly the granite capital of the world, no matter what how the state of New Hampshire bills itself. So, all right, let's talk about an exciting announcement we heard a little while ago from Norwich University about the Stone Arts Program that's created in connection with the museum. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it came about in my search to try to launch the Granite Museum Stone Arts School. I was trying to partner with an institution of higher education, and Professor Kevin Fleming from the psychology department, who's president of the Vermont Academy of Arts and Sciences, was giving an award, Lifelong Achievement Award, to Giuliano Ceccanelli, Barrie's sculptor. And Professor Fleming mentioned that, wow, this would be great if we could partner with Norwich. I said, well, in fact, I'm looking for a partner. And so since the fall of 2018, we've been working to try to develop a program at Norwich. It's going to be a Bachelor's of Science degree in the Design Arts. We chose Design Arts as the title of it because we didn't want folks to just to feel like it was the final artistic product that would be the only thing that students would get out of their experience, but it also the whole process of designing something. And we wanted students to understand, first and foremost, that much of the work that's being done in the granite industry and marble industries in North America is client or customer driven. So they've got an idea or concept in their head, and they want the artist to try to tease that out and create a final product that's pleasing to them. Mm-hmm. So it's driven by the customer as opposed to artists conceiving the artistic form from the very beginning and completing it and assuming someone out there is going to buy it. So it's a little different in terms of our expectations of what students are likely to do when they complete this degree. They're going to have two tracks to choose from, or they can blend the two. One is traditional stone sculpture, working side by side with our Vermont sculptors that are working in marble and stone and slate, and then also doing something in dry-laid stone. Much of the press this year has highlighted Chris Miller's work. Mm-hmm. He's been making these stone trucks all over North America. It's dry-laid stone. It's cut out of granite and just wonderful pieces. So we want to teach them how to do artistic dry-laid stone, but also traditional forms like the stone walls we see all around the state of Vermont. And so we want the students to kind of dabble in both these different traditional sculpting techniques and create something anew. And we want to bring to the degree also the opportunity to incorporate new tools such as 3D scanning, 3D printing, CNC machines or robotic arms, new technologies that maybe not are currently something that are being used by many artists, but could ultimately create something that's fantastic and never seen before.
Great. We're short on time. I'm going to try to get Judy in from Barrie. Judy, get right to your question or point.
Hi. I'm calling about the surface plate industry in Barrie. It originally started, I believe, at the Jones Brothers building, and then it moved up to Rock of Ages. And surface plate, precision granite, industrial products has been a big thing up there for manufacturing. The computer industry, the technology industry. And also I just wanted to ask about what are we doing to get our young people involved in any kind of granite industry, from sandblast to picking rubber, boxing it up, get these kids in there. Some kids don't go to college and they need a profession.
Judy, thanks for the question. Scott, we got about 30 seconds to answer that question.
The professional granite products is still very important to Rock of Ages production. And they lead that in North America. And they'll continue to do so by incorporating new technologies. Second, the youth, we're trying to incorporate those into the granite industry in two ways. One is through this program that we're doing with Norwich. We want to have a track for high school students as well. So you don't have to go to Norwich. You can do it through your own high school. Mm-hmm. Trying to create a partnership with the tech programs. And we're also interested in trying to get the kids involved by coming in, just exploring opportunities in the granite industry by maybe even partnering with the granite companies directly through the Barrie Granite Association's internship program, which they're trying to develop right now. So it's in the works. It's going to happen. Just give us a couple more years, and hopefully we'll have a nice conduit to get those kids back into the industry.
Scott McLaughlin is Executive Director of the Vermont Granite Museum in Barrie. The website, vtgranitemuseum.org. Scott, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the invitation.
All right, going to take a break for news. We'll return to hear from Lisa Ventris of Champlain College's Business School.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Our next guest you'll probably know for her almost two decades as president and CEO of the Vermont Business Roundtable, but Lisa Ventris retired from that position earlier this year. So much for a long retirement. Lisa has just been named as the interim dean of Champlain College's Robert P. Stiller School of Business. We now have the opportunity to speak with Lisa Ventris about her plans at Champlain. Lisa, I want to thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Oh, good morning, Rick. Thank you for the invitation.
Good morning. You're welcome. Listeners, to talk with Lisa about what drew her out of retirement, or if you're a business owner and would like to share the employment needs of the state, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Lisa, tell us about your new role at the Stiller School of Business at Champlain.
So my new role is interim dean, as you said, and my primary commitment and activities in this year ahead are to help the Champlain College and to help the Stiller School in particular to focus on strengthening our engagement with regional employers in this region of the state, but really all across the state of Vermont, and bring in business perspectives to help strengthen our curriculum, build on programs that we have to connect students with internships, mentors, other experiential learning opportunities throughout Vermont, and ideally help these students launch into gainful employment in Vermont when they graduate this spring.
You had retired from the Vermont Business Roundtable. So what was it that lured you into this position?
Well, it's funny because people had asked me, what is it, you know, what are you going to do after you retire? And I said, I don't know. I'm going to wait for the universe to find me. Hmm. And it took about 3 days for President Finney to call me and ask if I would consider this opportunity. But the considerations that I really embraced were that I have tremendous respect for the Champlain mission, which is to educate and prepare business leaders for Vermont's workforce. I've got high regard for Dave. When he was president, I had the pleasure of serving on the Board of Trustees during his tenure. And so that was a very positive experience. And I really love his leadership style, so wanted to be a part of that. But really, I felt that the responsibilities I have in this position are in alignment with the work that I did with the roundtable, mm-hmm. which is really to connect employers with higher education, develop the future workforce for the state, keep cycling employer needs into the education community, and make sure that there's alignment there. So I think that this was a very nice bridge to future retirement, which I hope to have at some point.
All right, Lisa. Eventually we'll let you retire. While you were at the roundtable, you did work at creating the Vermont Talent Pipeline. So explain what that is.
Sure. So this is an initiative actually that was created by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and was a model that they developed to, again, link employer demand with education, training, supply programming. I had the opportunity to go see a presentation on this with Commerce, Commissioner of Economic Development, Joan Goldstein. And when we were in that place, we knew that this really had potential for Vermont. So we brought this program back, which helps industry clusters come together to share information, employers from key industries getting together and sharing their information about job need, skills needs, and aggregating that information on behalf of an entire industry. We happen to be focused on construction, healthcare, and manufacturing. And then share that information with colleges, post-secondary education training programs, adult learning, and technical centers, and try to help students recognize that there is a career path that they can take that will help them gain employment and move up within these industry ladders. So it's been in place now for a handful of years. Mary Ann Sheehan is the executive director of it, and it's got a tremendous footprint all around the state.
Well, now you go from one end of the pipeline to the other, helping to feed it. How will Champlain fit into that?
So I think Champlain has a wonderful role to play in this. One of the first steps that I plan to take this year is to stand up a Dean's Advisory Council, which will be a group of business leaders that are going to be able to serve as advisors, ambassadors, and advocates for us, again, to help define not only where the emergent trends are within industry, but to connect directly to our faculty and students so that this whole ecosystem within the Stiller School, but Champlain College writ large, could benefit from this relationship. So my job really is to expand those networks and help connect our students to that type of experiential learning opportunity, to hear also from business about how we can continue to refine the education delivered at Stiller for these new developments within the business world.
Lisa, Champlain was founded in 1878 as Burlington Business School, so its roots are in this particular school. In 2021, what sets Champlain's business school apart from others?
Yes, it's got a great history, and it's fun to think that we're really just a few blocks away from our original, quote, campus down on Main Street. But today, what's very exciting about Champlain College is it has what we call an upside-down curriculum. And this is where I think students benefit immediately and ultimately the employer community as well. And by upside-down curriculum, we mean that they, students, gain more career-relevant experience in their fields earlier in their four-year college, so that by the time they are in the second semester of their sophomore year, they are ready to have industry-related internships. So they start their freshman year taking courses that speak directly to the degree that they wish to receive, rather than taking a bunch of more broad-based classes and electives. This really gets them going right away so that when these students reach the middle of their educational career, they're ready to go out into the field and have the benefit of all of that experiential learning.
Mm. Lisa, I'd like to look at some of the interesting concentrations that business students can add to their majors that people might not be aware of. And this is so very Champlain College to always be kind of ahead with this. One is activist marketing. What is that?
I'm glad that you've pointed to some of these because Champlain really has, I think, a reputation for just being risk takers and very innovative with their curriculum. But when we reflect on Stiller writ large, it was founded by Bob Stiller, who is the CEO and founder of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters. Excuse me. And Bob really was a champion of the belief that business has a higher purpose. And he had a very entrepreneurial mindset. And so the roots of his business philosophy really are pervasive within Stiller, that a business education should include the perspective that we champion people and products, cultures. And so this particular concentration then helps people to be able to be effective marketers for their business, their cause, their nonprofit organization, and it helps them to understand strategic community management that has to happen when people become leaders of their company and their cause. So this is one of the concentrations that is present within the BSBA degree. We have 11 concentrations, so it's we talk about students coming to Stiller, and if they don't see what they want to major in, there's probably a good chance that they can work with an advisor to help them create that particular degree that speaks to their needs and interests. And it's, again, that very entrepreneurial mindset that we see within the students who are coming into the college, and it plays out across their 4 years here.
I want to point out another one that has really gotten a lot of attention for the school because of the quality of the program in cybersecurity. Explain that.
Absolutely. We can all point to our recent history as a state and as a country where cybersecurity has suddenly become front of mind in so many business owners and leaders of complex organizations. So this is a concentration degree program that is based at our Leahy Cybersecurity Center down by the waterfront, and it helps students to become world-class leaders and operators within the world of cybersecurity. So if companies are looking for students with this very sophisticated mindset and familiarity, knowledge base around networks, network protocols, web applications, and security, this is the student that you're going to want to know about, and it's a very popular program.
Lisa, when I went to college, things have changed quite a bit since I got a degree in management, and I joined a club called Society for the Advancement of Management. Now at Champlain, you've got really interesting programs. I'd like to, again, highlight a few of them. Last September, Champlain Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship was selected as a partner in Vermont's Small Business Recovery Technical Assistance Program. What is that, and what steps have been taken in that direction?
CIE, Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, is one of our centers of experience where students can work. This is based down at Hula, and students can work with faculty advisors, industry representatives to bring an idea for a business that they might like to develop, expand a concept or a business that they perhaps have had in place already. Mm-hmm. And it gives these students direct, real world, as we say, interaction. And this is, again, something that we are very proud of, and believe that it can help with not only the student's development as a future business owner, but we see in the landscape around Burlington and Chittenden County and Vermont the outcomes of some of these experiences, and the reputation of Chittenden County as an entrepreneurial hub really is reinforced by this type of center, as well as VSET and Generator and Hula. It's really just a very vibrant community.
One more program I'd like to hear about is Stiller Women in Business.
Yes. So Stiller Women in Business is a wonderful group of women who have come together to create opportunities for mentoring with other women business leaders, business owners, to help develop the fabric of that relationship. Interestingly, at Champlain, we have 37% of our student population comprised of women. And so having a center, or excuse me, a group that is focused on women developing leadership skills, expanding their business networks, having those type of internships and experiential learning opportunities is what we're focusing on here. So I'll be actually speaking with them later this week, and I can't wait to meet all of them and hear directly what they're focused on.
Outstanding. We're always concerned about the brain drain in Vermont, losing these young people, whether they grew up here or came to college in Vermont. How do we keep the graduates of the Stiller School here in Vermont?
Well, I think the secret sauce that Stiller has is through our networks with the business community, which I said we're going to be expanding. But we have a very robust career collaborative that is on campus, and we've got a partner, Pat Boera, who works with our students to help develop, again, that catalog, if you will, of internship opportunities. We know that when students are able to have these kind of off-site work experiences, work on real-life projects with businesses and organizations, that they can see themselves in these roles, and they see that there is an employment opportunity for them in Vermont, that they do not necessarily have to leave. We know from businesses that they are you know, desperate to hire this tremendous talent. I think a recent report I saw was that our labor force is down still 5,000 people. So graduating students who have, as I said, experienced multiple internships, who have worked on real-life projects and have been applying their academic theory to the real world makes them prime candidates. And these students love Burlington. They love Vermont. This is why they came to Champlain College. So if they want to continue that type of lifestyle, then my job is to help introduce as many of them as possible to as many business leaders as possible.
I know you've taken this job coming out of retirement, taking it as an interim position, but how interim do you think this will be? You sound like you're already up to speed and ready to roll.
Well, I committed to Dave Finney that I would be here through the end of June, and that's my commitment to him. We will also be launching a search for a permanent dean. And so that is something that I'm helping the college do as well. But the nature of this work that I'm involved with now with Stiller is just an extension of the work I did before with the Roundtable. And so I'm really happy to be here. It's wonderful and fun to be around students every day. Mm-hmm. There's a great energy and tremendous vibe. The faculty love teaching. So it's a very, very positive place to be.
Lisa Ventra served as president and CEO of the Vermont Business Roundtable for 19 years. She's now the interim dean of Champlain College's Robert P. Stiller School of Business. To learn more about the School of Business, you can go to champlain.edu/academics. And Lisa, congratulations on the new position, and thank you for being on the program this morning.
Thank you, Rick, very much.
All right, take care. Now, news is next, and then we're going to be back to talk more business, this time with the Montpelier Development Corporation. And today at 1 o'clock, it's Travels with Charlie Papillo. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. In the last segment, we discussed how Champlain College is preparing graduates to meet the needs of businesses in Vermont and elsewhere. Now we're going to learn about an organization working to attract businesses to Montpelier, including through a grant program. Joining me to explain how they're doing just that is Bill Kaplan, the Board of Directors Chair of the Montpelier Development Corporation. Bill, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Hi. All right. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Bill about the work of the MDC, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bill, what is the MDC?
Well, MDC, I think we have to go back about 7 years ago when the city of Montpelier decided it wanted to look forward in a long-term way and come up with some planning to come up with to understand how the city works and grows. And so they hired an outside consultant who came up with a economic development plan. In that plan, there were a number of ideas. One that the city council latched onto was a group of local residents who had expertise both knowing the city and business and economic development. And so 5 years ago, MDC was formed by the city council, and we've worked over the years since then to create jobs, to bring businesses into Montpelier, to help retain businesses, and just come up with ideas of how to support. And then more than ideas, we've brought dollars to the table and delivered them.
Is it part of the city government, or what's the structure?
Yeah, great question. It is not. It is a independent, not-for-profit organization that is supported, or was supported and founded by the city, but is not any longer.
When I think of business in in Montpelier, I primarily think of, you know, State and Main Streets, downtown. Are there other areas of the city that are right for businesses to locate in?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, we have along Route 2, there's industrial and office space out there. There is just along the river is just incredibly rich for new development. We saw that. We worked, one of our first projects was working with Caledonia Spirits to come here. And I don't know, Rick, if you visited, but it is just an incredible mm-hmm. both manufacturing facility, but just a social community place where we can enjoy what they make and meet others and really appreciate the riverfront and the outdoors.
Yeah, it is beautiful and a real coup to have them there. What did it take to have Caledonia Spirits Bar Hill move into Montpelier?
Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of effort by the city, by MDC, by Montpelier Alive. I'm going to forget all the folks that came to it, but I think that the efforts, were really on MDC's part was just to keep communication going. And because all the other groups had, many other responsibilities, MDC made sure that this kept rising to the top. So when there was a railroad crossing issue, or there was a sewer issue, or there was a relocation of water lines, that just those conversations kept moving along at a pace. And then also supporting the business itself and talking to them about what it means to buy property and how to own it. And they were, everybody was fully competent to do it on their own. All we did was just kind of sit on the sidelines and cheer folks along.
Mm.
Make sure it didn't stall. Really.
Yeah. Any other additions of note that you've been able to help bring into the city?
Sure. We worked with around 8 new employers that resulted in about 100 new jobs. We also worked with the city intensely to create the tax incremental financing district, which is a state authorized program so that a new development or business can come in and actually defer the taxes that would have hit them as they started, actually get deferred, and there is a public infrastructure addition that the city is able to fund with that, with those tax dollars. They are redirected and sent into infrastructure, extending water lines, creating underground wires, or burying wires, mm-hmm. or whatever that may be, new sidewalks, etc.
Now, I've been talking about additions, Bill, so far, but how does MDC work with existing companies in the city to help them?
Yeah, we have a board of eight folks, and it ranged from real estate experts to business experts to banking and insurance, marketing, and just a broad range of experience. So really what you get with MDC is, a team of kind of advisors and consultants, just a resource to look at. And I should say that we were chartered for 5 years. And what we're going to talk about today, which I'm excited to go on about, is kind of the culmination of these 5 years. We're going to launch this grant. Mm-hmm. I think I'd also like to go back and talk about, what we did in response to COVID, because
sure.
I think everyone was caught a little flat-footed and not understanding what it was. Upon realizing the magnitude of this, we funded a position to help businesses find the resources and all the navigate the programs. So we we funded through Montpelier Alive a business navigator, a COVID business navigator, to help the businesses. And then I think as that went on, we realized we needed to do more, and we were actually going to have to change from being kind of behind the scenes to step up and really bring some both dollars and enthusiasm to Main Street in Montpelier. So we within literally a couple weeks, we raised a little over $200,000 from area businesses and individuals. And then we're able to distribute that to 74 downtown businesses. So it was, a monetary boost, but it was also a real show of support from the community, where people who were down in the dumps and really not understanding where, as everyone was, not knowing where this was going to go, could feel the support, even if they didn't see the people coming through the doors. So, we gave out all that money. We funded the administrative and kind of all the, we greased, we paid for all the mechanisms that got that money out. Every mm-hmm. dollar that came in, we put it directly in the hands of downtown businesses and storefronts, so that, they knew that the city, the community at large, the Montpelier has such a big commuting group that comes in and supports everyone. Mm-hmm. So when everyone started telecommuting, we needed to really just say, people are still out there. They'll be back. If you say you'll try, we'll give you these dollars.
So, you've mentioned the group Montpelier Alive a couple times. Explain who they are and how you work with them.
Well, Montpelier Alive has been around for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And they are a downtown-focused community group that very dedicated folks who have an office in the city, in City Hall, and work on day-to-day experience of downtown. Now, I'm reticent to talk for them about what they do, but sure. They have huge impact from concerts downtown to running the organizing events, the 4th of July, the Christmas lights, all the beautiful flowers you see downtown, And then I know their executive director, Dan Groberg, goes door to door and knows every business owner who, you know, is engaged in the downtown activity. So they're really the front line of downtown.
Bill, now's your chance to sell people on locating a business in Montpelier. And before we get into the business climate there, what are the attributes of the city that make it a place businesses want to be?
Sure. Well, I think you have a few aspects that few cities in the country actually can claim, if any, are, and none is as unique as Montpelier. You have the stability of the downtown with both insurance companies downtown and also city government and state government. And so there's a real base there. You also have a college on the hill. There is a rounded nature to this community that is rare to find in, although we are technically a city, I want to say a town. You know, we are a community that is town with the idea that people know each other. There's a caring and concern here that is really deep and strong, which makes it just a very livable place. There are independent bookstores. There are two independent movie houses. There's an art, art house films and mainstream films. Mm-hmm. We have a hotel downtown. There are all kinds of restaurants spawned by the fact that Necky was founded here and brought a lot of people here. I listening to Lisa earlier about Champlain and the idea that people come here to go to college and educate and then fall in love. That happened here. We have an abundance of chefs and good food. So it's a very rich, rich community for that has maintained its uniqueness and just appeal for families and individuals to live. It's easy to get out of town and get into the woods and nature. The river runs right through it. Mm-hmm. Really quintessential living that's rare to find anywhere in the country these days. I travel a fair amount and see towns that used to be like Montpelier but are no longer. So yeah. It's a real treasure.
And what are the advantages for businesses to locate there?
Sure. Well, I think the same advantages that I just spoke about we want people to be happy. We want people to be able to educate their kids in some of the best schools in the country. We want employment, stability. We want a vibrancy that's brought by, the 20,000 workers come to Montpelier every day. It's a town of 7,000 or 8,000, but we grow every day by these big numbers, and that's what supports our downtown. I think people here feel a real commitment to the downtown. We have a kitchen store. It's just incredible what you have for resources. And you go in and the people know you and smile. And it's really a place we'd love people to come and take a look. And what happens is you fall in love and you really say, hey, if there's any way I could come and work here or live here, I'd like to. And that's what we're doing here with our final endeavor. We our grant program was earlier what we called the MEND grant, which was mid-pandemic, where we gave out $200,000 to downtown directly from people to the people who made our main street here. This is a bigger one. This is one that we are looking to bring in or support a entity that wants to make Montpelier its permanent and long-term home. As we kind of end our charter, we want to leave a legacy. And so we have $100,000 that we are going to divide up or, however we can use it best, mm-hmm. but not too small. Last time we gave out, it was maybe $1,500 to $6,000 grants. This time we're going to give out, they're all going to be five figures. They're going to be meaningful dollars given out when someone opens their business and makes that commitment. And And so we're looking forward to creating businesses that will be here a long time, that will support, will blend in and work with the community. And we want to actually, you know, I think that the board believes that because of that richness, that diversity that is here, we want to expand that. We want, you know, we're favoring underrepresented small businesses here. If you get a little, you know, we have a matrix of how we're going to award this. And so one of the aspects that we're looking for, we're trying to encourage people to come here and make our community richer in not just an economic. I know we're an economic development corporation. However, we understand the deepness and the importance of having wide range of views, wide range of people and personalities. And we believe that holds true for businesses as well.
This program is called the Montpelier Grows Grant Program. Who can apply, Bill?
So anyone who has a business or is an entrepreneur and wants to grow in Montpelier, whether you're an existing Montpelier business or you want to come to Montpelier, you know, and what we've tried to do is craft a way to award this that is going to assess the long-term impact of the grant recipient. So if you have you or your business you know, and group that you work with, it could be a not-for-profit. I mean, they're all part of our downtown community, but it needs to be something that's going to create jobs, create identity for Montpelier, and that will be has some feasibility to it. You know, this group is a really focused board that wants to not necessarily get credit, and that's why many people haven't heard of MDC, mm-hmm. but wants to have impact. It's all about impact. There are a lot of really highly accomplished folks on our board that just like to see results, and I think that's what this grant is looking to achieve and will achieve.
This $100,000 grant program, how is it financed?
So we have about 3 years ago, prior to the pandemic, actually, we shifted from having an executive director to a real project-based, again, kind of mimicking the belief of the board that we just want every dollar to be maximized and to go directly to impactful activities. So we hire project managers for each one. And as a result of that, we were able to create this fund, knowing that we had 5 years and that this was going to, you know, we wanted to have some impact if a big project came along. I think that the idea was let's save and keep this, and now it's time. There's nothing else for us to do here but, you know, find the recipients of this grant.
Is there a requirement for how long a business has to stay in Montpelier, or how many jobs that they'll add to the local economy?
Well, I guess if someone came to us and said we're going to do a pop-up business, you know, and then move on, that they would score low on our matrix. The idea being, we want someone who's really looking to be here for the long term. You can see what we did in the past, you know, supporting Caledonia. Looking at, you know, we really were disappointed about the hotel not coming, although we're very happy that, Capitol Plaza is doing well and has kind of really, been making a great comeback out of the pandemic and is signed up with Hilton now as a part of their network so that, they're supported and people know about them when they look on their phones and Google and, you know, have their hotel searches.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the big ideas are the ones that attract, Montpelier Development Corporation to doing it, to funding. And so I think that, the idea is that this, you're going to make this your home. You know, this will be your long-term place of business.
Looking at the Montpelier business landscape, do you see certain types of businesses that would be a good fit for the city?
You know, that's a great question, and there's probably only answers are in the people who are ready to make that decision to start the business or to bring the business here. Because I think that, yes, the idea of urban planning and city planning and, you know, all of that is great. It's theory, though. You need someone who's passionate. You need someone who's ready to put their kind of heart, soul, and efforts into making a business work. And if someone has an idea and they push it, I think it works. I think, you know, a great example of that is Three Penny Tap Room downtown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where I remember people saying, oh, who really needs more beers and blah, you know, all that. And boy, is that place great. And it's thriving, and you get a diversity of beers. You get support. They really have rode the wave of growth in Vermont beers. They're on so many Vermont beer tours, and just a place that people from out of the state and in the state want to go. Locals, tourists, everyone. It's just, you know, but the idea that you're gonna, you know, charge more for a beer and people will appreciate it was, I heard a lot of, I don't know, a questioning of that idea, but they're passionate. They believed in it. They made it happen. And I think that's a great example.
Yeah, it
so
really is.
I'm always reticent to hear someone say, oh, we need, you know, a paperclip manufacturer. I don't know how you prescribe that. Somebody's got to have a passion.
We used to have a Closeman manufacturer there in Montpelier.
Yeah, what a building that is.
Yeah. Bill Kaplan is the chair of the Montpelier Development Corporation Board of Directors. Listeners, to learn more about the MDC, you can visit mdc-vermont.com. Bill, thanks for being on the program this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure thing. All right, take care. All right, let's break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to head to Tunbridge to the Villa Villacoula Farm. We'll check in on the farm's owner, and we're going to see how the goats are doing. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I've been focused a lot on Tunbridge lately, more by coincidence than a concerted effort to give this wonderful little town extra love. Recently, I've spoken with the owners of Hoyt Hill Farmstead. I visited the World's Fair and learned about the White River Land Collaborative. Today, we're going to meet the owner of a one-woman operation in Tunbridge, and we'll also check in on the well-being of her goats, because this story has some parallels of what happened recently at the Hoyt Farm. Joining me now is the owner of Villa Villacoula Farm, Lauren Gitlin. Lauren, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
How'd I do with the name?
That was perfect. Yeah, okay. Well done.
All right, good. Hey, if we were playing Wheel of Fortune and you asked for a V on Villa Villacoula on Vermont Viewpoint, you would have done very, very well.
That is true. Yeah, good point.
All right. Now, listeners, to ask Lauren about her farm, you can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Lauren, give us a little tour of the Villa Villacoula farm.
Sure, yeah. So I live here with my 27 goats. Moved down here with just three at the end of 2018, so do the math on that. So I've been renting some acreage and a creamery facility here since then, and share the property with a few other families who are doing farming as well. And it took me about a year to start getting my operation online. I began making a product called Skyr, which is an Icelandic fermented dairy product, very similar to yogurt. And, you know, in the last year or so, I've just been kind of trying to build my business and care for the goats and be a good steward of the land. And, you know, the cornerstone of my business is really, you know, caring for the animals and seeing their humanity and seeing seeing them as, you know, kind of colleagues rather than employees, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah, and, you know, prior to that, I had worked at a number of other small goat dairies in Vermont and tried to gather as much information and knowledge as I could. But, you know, it's always such a learning process, and that's part of the appeal of this sort of work, is that there's always more to learn, and with challenges come opportunities to grow and to deepen your understanding of the animals in the landscape and the sort of alchemy that goes on in the dairy.
Mm. Villa Villa Coola is a great name, but does Pippi Longstocking ever call or write and let you know how she feels about you using it?
She hasn't been in touch. I'm not sure if she's hip to email yet. I'm not sure if that's part of her toolkit. So I'm just going to operate under the assumption that she's a fan.
All right, good. Why did you choose the name?
Pippi Longstocking was a favorite of mine as a child, and I love everything she represents. She's a very free-spirited, whimsical, but very, very strong-willed and strong-minded kid, super independent, and kind of mischievous, but kind-hearted and generous and sort of open to all the wonder around her. So that felt like a really good set of values to kind of, you know, attempt to embody as my one woman operation. And she has red hair, I have red hair, you know, so it just felt like the right fit to have sort of a guidepost for my business.
If you didn't call it Villa Villa Coola Farm, she probably would have gotten in touch the day after to say, Lauren, what are you doing over there?
Yeah, highly likely.
Yeah. Now you have kind of touched on the pretty interesting career that has brought you to this farm, but let's talk about some of it. You worked for Rolling Stone magazine. What do you do there?
I started out as an editorial intern, and then I kind of moved my way up in the ranks a bit. I was an editorial assistant in the music department for the music editor and the albums editor, and then I spent a little while as an associate online editor. So I spent about four years there, start to finish, and that was actually my first like grown-up job out of college. So it was a pretty cool gig. Lots mm-hmm. of good perks. Yeah, it was fun.
Any kind of music that you particularly like? Anybody you want to tell us about? Any bands?
Oh, geez. my gosh.
What music do you play for the goats, I guess?
the goats really like Stevie Nicks and Fleetwood nice. Mac. Not a fan of bluegrass. Not a fan. not fans of bluegrass at all. Yeah, but their taste is pretty eclectic, but they do have their preferences. Yeah. So no, you know, I'm not really hip to what's going on in the current musical landscape right now. I think I get a lot of I get a lot of my musical recommendations from TV shows these days, which I think maybe is not an uncommon thing, but
right.
Yeah, you know, given that a lot of the work I do is pretty solitary and repetitive, it's always nice to have, you know, either a podcast or some music going in the background to keep me company.
You spent some time in the wine business. What did you do there?
I had, you know, I kind of decided to veer off the journalism trajectory and started looking into working in food, and I was getting a master's at NYU in culinary anthropology and needed a part-time job, and so I started working as just a part-time sales clerk at my local wine shop, which really was a pretty noteworthy wine shop in Brooklyn at the time. It was sort of at the frontier of this sort of natural wine movement that has now become very popular and ubiquitous. But so again, it was the kind of thing where I started, you know, at the bottom and then kind of worked my way up to a buyer manager position there. And that was really fun, you know, just having a chance to be exposed to these beautiful wines that I probably would never otherwise have had access to or had the budget to be able to enjoy. And, you know, I think there are a lot of parallels, obviously, between wine and cheese. You know, they're both food products that are sort of an embodiment of this idea of terroir, of like the landscape kind of informing the distinctiveness of a food product. And I found, you know, that they're, that seems to be the kind of thing that, you know, we're chasing. A lot of us, like small dairy producers, are chasing that idea and trying to sort of really capture a landscape and capture a sort of culturally specific flavor. So I think, you know, when I learned about wine, it was really easy to also kind of see some analogies in cheese and in dairy.
And as you mentioned, you worked at a number of different farms. Why was that what you gravitated to, working on a farm?
Well, it was a few reasons. I mean, I had spent about a dozen years in New York City, and, you know, I think a lot of people, in my peer group at least, sort of fantasize about this idea of, you know, running away to like become a farmer or a shepherd or something, because, you know, the daily grind of that urban existence can really get you down. And for a lot of people, it ends up just being kind of a pipe dream. But for me, it ended up being a reality. And, you know, I think particularly working with wine and with cheese, and wanting to get really a deeper understanding of what it was and how it was made, it seemed like the obvious next step. You know, just talking about it and reading about it and tasting it wasn't enough. I really wanted to get to the root of how all of these things fit together, from, you know, how the grass grew and how the animals were cared for, to how the cheese was made and how it was aged in caves. And, you know, I just wanted to be able to have like a really holistic understanding of how this like really beautiful piece of food came into existence. And I think it was a combination of this really deep curiosity and like a sort of desire to sort of map out a different life for myself after over a decade in the city.
Which you did. You then made off with three of someone's goats and started Villa Villa Coola. Tell us that story.
Well, I kind of bopped around. I mean, the real impetus for me moving to Vermont was to work with Lainey Fondler at Lazy Lady Farm. She was someone that I'd sort of heard all sorts of folklore about. She's kind of a legend, and, you know, I really wanted to learn from her and work for her. And so my entree into working with goats really was more about working with Lainey, and she just happened to have goats. And I spent about a year with her, and then I spent another year at Twig Farm in Addison County with Michael Lee, and then I was at Consider Bardwell for a period of time as well. And then I went back up to Lazy Lady for a part of another season, and was just kind of casting about for what the next step was going to be. And Lainey was retiring a couple of goats, including one who was a favorite of mine. And, you know, just kind of on a whim, I started looking for a place to potentially board goats, because at the time I didn't have any farmland or any barn space. I was I was renting an apartment from a friend of mine, and so I started exploring what might be possible if I decided I wanted to just have these goats even as pets, and an opportunity to rent this this barn and creamery space kind of just fell into my lap, and I felt like, you know, this was probably my best shot at taking a gamble on this idea to have a farm business of my own. Given that I was, you know, alone and didn't really have the means to buy a property or the skill to start building infrastructure from scratch, you know, having an opportunity to rent basically a turnkey operation and have a community of other farm people around me as mm-hmm. like kind of a support system felt like, you know, the best possible situation for someone like me. And, you know, I pursued it and it wound up working out really, really well. And all of the people that I share this land with are very kind, generous, hardworking people. And I've been able to find a community here and I'm just really, really grateful for that.
Mm. Lauren, I want to talk about when your goats were acting funny. Now, goats kind of act funny as a rule anyway. So first of all, how could you tell something was a little strange about their behavior?
Yeah, you're right. They do. They are funny creatures, but they all have very distinct personalities, which is part of what I love about them. So I think the incident you're referring to is a day when I went out to pasture to retrieve them from their paddock to bring them in for milking. And ordinarily I have a very young and very energetic goat named Potato, who is always eagerly anticipating running back to the barn to get her dinner. And she ordinarily is right in front of the gate, ready to barrel down the hill towards the barn. And on this particular day, she was hanging back. She was lying down. She didn't seem interested in getting up. And I noticed right away that that was unusual for her. And when I finally got her up, I noticed that another one of my goats was kind of wobbly and, seemed unsteady on her feet. And so it became very clear to me, that something was off. And then I noticed that, one of them had what appeared to be green paint on her nose. And it had a very strong chemical kind of metallic, odor. So, you know, it started to dawn on me, oh no, something bad has happened. They've, you know, it seemed as though they had gotten into something. So, you know, I got everybody back to the barn. I set to work trying to get ready for my evening milking. I had some friends visiting from out of town, and they volunteered to go back to the paddock and kind of hunt around to see if there was anything obvious that they might have eaten. I had built a brand new paddock for them that morning, so they were only in there for, you know, maybe 7 hours. My friend came back to me and showed me a picture that she'd taken on her phone of what appeared to be a partially ripped plastic bag of this kind of greasy green concentrate that had been kind of buried at the base of an electrical pole that was inside of that paddock. And it seemed pretty obvious at that point, given what was on my goat's muzzles, that was, in fact, what they had consumed. And over the course of the next 24 hours, three of my goats started exhibiting pretty obvious symptoms of poisoning, at varying, you know, levels of severity. One was very, very sick and, very, very much on the verge of death for several days. You know, I worked very closely with my vet to try to come up with a protocol for treating them. And there really was nothing I could do other than to just give them massive amounts of fluid, to kind of flush the poison out. And I'm happy to say that they all made, recovery and are now back to their old tricks and, don't seem any worse for the wear. But there was a good solid week or 10 days where I was very worried that they weren't going to make it.
Mm. And they are fine. Other than Potato and the two other goats having these ill effects, has it had a negative effect on any part of your business?
Yes. The challenge I'm facing now is in determining when and whether The milk from the two lactating goats that were affected by this poisoning will be deemed safe for commercial use. It's a really unique and difficult challenge because there's really no precedent for this specific substance being found in food, so there's no record of what is safe and admissible. And so I've been having to work very closely with the Agency of Agriculture and other scientific experts to try to determine those levels. At this point, you know, this incident happened July 31st, so we're, you know, nearly 2 months out. And, you know, I've since that time, since the time that I was able to determine which goats were affected, I've been dumping the milk from the two does that were affected. And right now I'm only milking six goats total. So that's a third of my milk supply that I can't use for commercial, production. And that's been pretty devastating for me. You know, I was just about a year out from having gotten my milk handler's license and was growing my business and sort of widening my, my roster of vendors that were working with my product and really looking forward to kind of building that momentum. And so to have something like this happen, was really pretty crushing to my business. And I'm still not really in the clear yet because, you know, there's really no, there's no clear path forward in terms of whether or not the milk from those animals can ever be used for commercial production again.
Lauren, we have about a minute and a half left. What can you tell us about where that substance came from and how long it was there?
Yeah, so the substance is called copper naphthenate. It's a pesticide that is commonly used as a wood treatment for these electrical poles, and it was applied by a contractor that was hired by Washington Electric when they were maintaining the poles. And I'm not entirely sure when it was mistakenly left behind. Typically, they treat the poles and then kind of backfill the hole that the pole is in. But someone had left it behind by mistake. And, you know, according to Washington Electric's records, those poles were installed in 2005. So it could have been there for anywhere between, you know, at least 15 or 16 years. So Washington Electric has been willing to work with me to try to, you know, make my business whole, but it's really unclear, you know, the best way to do that. I'm still kind of awaiting guidance from the state to figure out what labs need to be done and who can pay for those labs.
Another sad tale to hear, unfortunately, in Tunbridge. We also heard from the Hoyt Hill Farmstead about what happened there. Lauren Gitlin is the owner of the one-woman goat farm, Villa Villa Coola Farm in Tunbridge. You can learn more at villavillacoolafarm.com. Lauren, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning, and give my best to Potato and the rest of the gang.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. All right, that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.